Hey James, thank you for coming in. You have a really interesting background from your sports history, and you're quite sort of dynamic in that area, and to your work in economics and things like that, and then into executive search, and then with family offices, and now investments in many different ways. So, just really fascinating, all the sort of pieces of what makes you do all the things you do. So I'm fascinated by it, and I'm quite enthused of having you share your insights with our audience.
Well, thank you for having me, Stephen. I'm a big fan of yours and the great work that you do. So it's an honor for me to be on, and hopefully I'll have some nuggets that might be helpful to others. So.
So the first question I always ask, and it's because my audience is really quite diverse. I mean, I actually have students in my audience and engineers and scientists. But the top five are actually executives. They're board members, presidents, CEOs, and founders of companies and things like that. So, but the curiosity is you've got this marvelous career. You've done so many amazing things, and you continue to make so many global contributions. What were those inflection points in your life that made you who you are today? And it could have been when you were really young, it could have been in middle school, high school, it could be mentors, so many family members, could it be something you did, or in university, or in your career. There's got to be these magic moments that made you who you are today.
Yeah, well, thank you. I feel, first off, just incredibly blessed in terms of the life that I've led, and the people who have helped see potential in me that I didn't see in myself, and help guide and mentor me forward. So I sit here very, very blessed. But look, I think for me, a couple of inflection points to answer your question. So I grew up in San Antonio, Texas, and just some context setting in Texas. There's this pecking order that goes high school football, and then depending upon how the Dallas Cowboys, or maybe the Houston Texans these days, are doing, God is either second or third, and that's holds true across the Hindus, Christians, Muslims, people of the Jewish faith, and so it. But that's all a way to say it has a powerful emotional hold on your life, particularly when you're in high school. And in 1979, I was a freshman in high school, and my high school in San Antonio, and in rival high school, predominantly all white high schools, won the city championship. We alternated for 10 or 11 years up in a row up until 1979. And prior to the start of the season, I was looking through a magazine, the San Antonio Football Magazine. So kind of a preview of the year to come, highlighting teams, predictions, et cetera. And in flipping through it, I came across San Antonio Wheatley High School. Wheatley caught my attention because my aunt had worked in Houston Wheatley in the early 70s, started the first advanced math program there. So the name caught my attention. And there was a picture of a player for Wheatley, a gentleman named Kenneth Roberts, and big offensive lineman. He was literally palming a football helmet in his hand, and something about the name Wheatley and Kenneth palming that helmet that's just caught my attention. And they were predicted to finish, in the middle of their district. But and the reality was, whoever won their district, when they came up against teams like ours or our rival, they were an afterthought. We didn't even give them much consideration. But what happened during that year is that team, the ultimate underdog, came out of nowhere. And my father had a medical practice on the side of south side of San Antonio, which is where schools like Wheatley, the inner city schools, the majority non-white schools were located. And as they had this magical journey, I started seeing a sense of a change in energy in that community. And there was a sense of pride that these kids who represented them, people from that community, were doing something special, and people felt a part of that journey. Now they won the city championship. And I just remember thinking, God, this is really interesting. I wanted to, it sparked a curiosity in me to understand who are these people that aren't from my community, what drives them. And Kenneth Roberts, who has become a very good friend, I met him later in life. But and so what happened is I also competed in track and field, and at track meets, you show up at 10 in the morning, it's a 10 or 12 hour event because there's multiple events, hurdles, pole vault, shot. I threw the shot put not very well, but it allowed me a chance to get to know kids from other schools. And I'd have these deep conversations and was really intrigued and impressed with the talent that I was meeting from these other schools. And we talk about life and what you wanted to get out of life. And the reality was, for most of these kids, the only way out, the only way to college was through athletics, right? They had to get an athletic scholarship. And I found that deeply troubling as a kid. And it just, it continued to spurn this curiosity in me, you know, and ultimately kind of the key inflection point came in 1981, when my high school, we made it to the state semifinals, played against a school called Jack Yates, an all African-American school. And we lost this epic game, and very close game. And this team, you know, at the end out thought us, out executed us, kind of defied all the stereotypes on what people had about all African-American or all non-majority white sports teams. And there was just a magic about that game and that night. And I actually got to know the guys we played against. And again, something about just that night and kind of the way they broke through. It was one thing for a school like Wheatley to win a city championship, but to break through and make it to state was just such a symbolic event, and one that continues to resonate to this day. But that's when I kind of said to myself, I need to do something different. I want to make a difference in the lives of the guys I've gotten to meet, the people I've played against. And that's kind of my why, right? And I knew at a young age that creating access to opportunity for the guys that I played against was kind of my calling and mission. So that was a key inflection point. And I have to say, as a shout out to my friends from Jack Yates, the guys I played against, Thomas Ledet, Sebastian Harris, those guys have opened my eyes and helped shape the course of my life in the most wonderful of ways. I love them. They are my brothers on this journey. So that was really kind of my first inflection point, if you will. And anyway.
So, yeah, I mean, so that's really quite interesting, right? Because you were a little bit in a bubble before that, right?
Yes, very much so.
And that bubble opened into a much broader landscape, and you were curious, and you wanted to find out more, and that shaped your journey for your entire life, and it still continues to be part of your life. That in fact, it's probably one of the major inflection points in your life, right? Because you got and gained insight into more. And the wider possibilities. And I guess that's the issue in today's world. People live in these little silos, but they don't see the broader possibilities and this aspect that we're really all connected. So continue your inflection point reflections here. Any others outside of this early one?
Yeah, no, I went to Columbia University to do a doctorate in economics, and a gentleman named Jagdish Bhagwati took me under his wing. He's been, I think, nominated now 10 times for the Nobel Prize in Economics, one of the real thought leaders in international trade, economic development. He was Paul Krugman's mentor as well at MIT, when he was at MIT. And as I like to say, between Krugman and myself, that's the full range of capabilities, right, in terms of his students. But he encouraged me not to become an academic. And instead, he said, I don't know what you will wind up doing, but you have a real talent for connecting with people. I trust you, work with me. And at the time, he was architecting with Manmohan Singh, then finance minister, future prime minister of India, India's economic liberalization, and was also working with Arthur Dunkel, who was the director general of what used to be the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the GATT, to create the World Trade Organization. So that was an inflection point in many ways. It opened my eyes to the rest of the world. I'd been outside the U.S. once, which is to Kenya and Tanzania in 84 with my parents. But through working with Professor Bhagwati, I just met people, leaders from all around the world who were shaping the world in very interesting and powerful ways. I wound up spending time at the Japanese Ministry of Finance, not because of me. They wanted him and he sent me. So that was a big inflection point in terms of opening my aperture globally. And then I left econ, I left left academics, and again a chance meeting with a woman named Rusty Meyer, Hazel Rusty Meyer, the first female senior EVP on Wall Street, and she convinced me that this thing called client server technology was going to forever change how Wall Street, what Wall Street needed in a technology leader. It would go, you know, CTOs prior to client server reported to a CFO. It was more of a back office function, less strategic. And with the advent of client server, all of a sudden CTOs were reporting to CEOs, and technology was a core driver of business in a way that it hadn't been in the past. And we started a recruiting firm to help Wall Street find senior technology talent, and had a wonderful run, wound up selling that to Manpower Diversified Search in 2000. So meeting Rusty was an inflection point, because that was my first, in some ways, foray into business. Well, it was a great experience. And since then, I've been on in venture and private equity, and have had the privilege of working with some incredible people. And as you know, you're in that space. I mean, the innovation, the learning, the people that you meet through that process. And I feel like I'm a student. I'm continually learning and continuing to grow and expand.
So right now, then, I can see all of these prominent elements, you know, very interdisciplinary, very inclusive, diversity, equity is part of that. You know, including when you played against this you know, Jack Gates Lions, and in fact, the players became friends, and it opened up really your whole mindscape of the possibilities. And then you go to Columbia University, but it's international economics, so it's a much broader landscape again, and especially because your mentor was looking at sort of these monetary policies and opening up globally, you know, what that could mean from an economic sort of inclusion standpoint, but empowerment. And it's interesting that he recommended you don't pursue an academic career, but leverage your community mind, your interrelationship mind with your, you know, you still are brilliant in economics and so on. Okay. And you ended up with a PhD, right? And but combining that, and then you end up with a certificate with a monetary fiscal policy with the Japanese Ministry of Finance, because you work there again as part of this kind of this team with a professor. But it opened again to a broader perspective, right? And in fact, I believe you still think that Japan still has a lot of possibilities, even though they've been kind of like stationary, right? There was this sort of feeling that they were going to overtake the U.S. in the 80s, but they never, yes. Right? They never overtook the 80s. So let's go back to that. But then you end up on Wall Street. You end up doing this boutique technology executive search firm at the right time, right? Because as you mentioned, client server. And you had some great clients, you know, like American Express, Bankers Trust, Charles Schwab, J.P. Morgan. And you ended up exiting out of that as well, which gave you even more financial capability to then get into some of the work that you're doing now. So, but let's get back to Japan. Yeah. I mean, because I think that was interesting for you. Can you give us more details about that experience? Because the Japanese culture is really different.
It's very, very, very different. But at the time, this is 1992. So think about, if you go back and time, in particular, a lot of countries are starting to liberalize, starting to embrace more market-oriented policies, monetary policy, trade policy. And Japan, to their credit, was very strategic about building relationships with those countries. And they put together a program where they brought over mid-level, but very talented mid-level members of the ministries of finance from countries like Vietnam, Peru, Hungary. In fact, and I was part of that program. In fact, one of our participants, Csaba László, went on to become the finance minister for Hungary, right? So it was a great, great experience in terms of getting exposure and kind of seeing these countries open through the eyes of the people that were leading their liberalization. It was fascinating. In Japan, for some reason, I just connected with Japan. I think, you know, the Japanese have this this notion of tatemae and hone. Hone is who you truly are. Tatemae is what you show to the rest of the world. And frequently, tatemae and hone are very different. But in Texas, where I grew up, it was kind of the same, right? The tatamae, what you show to the rest of the world, people were always opening doors and outside, very, for the most part, very polite, although that not didn't necessarily reflect how they felt inside. So I think maybe because of that cultural similarity, I just felt I just kind of fit in with Japan. So.
But you still maintain relationships, right? And do you
Oh,
still
yes.
speak a little bit of Japanese or?
Survival Japanese. And my son, in fact, is my 15-year-old son plays on the Japanese or played on the Japanese 16U national basketball team and has been invited to play for the 18U Japanese basketball team next year. So very still very close and very connected to Japan and very bullish on Japan, by the way. I think they've gone through a 30-year cycle trying to find themselves, but I'm cautiously optimistic they're if they can continue on the path they're on. I think Japan's going to come back in a pretty significant way.
So it sounds like your son is resident in Japan.
Well, here's an interesting thing: when you're within the first 6 months of your being born, if you file the appropriate paperwork, you can have effectively dual citizenship. So he has a Japanese passport and a U.S. passport, but we live in New York, and he trains here in New York with the gauchos and this great community here. But you know, probably I would expect 2 to 3 months this in 2024 he'll be in Japan training or Japan or abroad playing in tournaments.
So it sounds like his language skills are better than yours.
Yes. That's a low bar, Stephen, but still, yes. I'll give him credit.
Okay, so you were co-founder of RLM Associates, this
Yes.
search firm. You had these great clients. We mentioned some of them, including Payne Weber and so forth, and eventually sell it, but and that gives you some financial capability, more options. So can you talk about your journey after that? Where did you
Sure. Yeah, so after that in those days, so think back to 2000, it was very fashionable for venture firms to bring on human capital partners to manage the portfolio. If you remember, you know, venture capital was considered a talent acquisition business. I still think to a large extent that's true. So I was interviewing with different venture firms and to become a human capital partner. And I remember, I won't name the firms, but having three meetings that essentially where I'd walk into a room, there'd be a partner across the table who would give me a spreadsheet and told me how much money I could make if I worked with them. And I'd say, "My name is James. How are you?" I mean, I was just sort of that mindset just did not connect with me. And then I met Kevin Kimberlin. Kevin, first investor in Millicom, which became Vodafone, had a family office that was investing in all kinds of interesting, effectively seed and pre-seed projects across a wide range of industries. And I remember at the time him telling me, you know, we're losing a world trade, the equivalent of a World Trade Center a day to HIV/AIDS. I, Kevin, have co-founded a company with the late Jonas Salk called Immune Response to develop a therapeutic vaccine for people infected with HIV/AIDS, and I need your help. And I said, I'm working with him. And I joined a firm called Spencer Trask, which was very interesting at the time. It was a family office where Kevin did the initial financing. And then as deals progressed, they would take it out to, at the time, which was the largest angel network. So think back circa 2000, he had roughly, I think, close to 5,000 angels that would co-invest. And the idea was to bring in angels that had domain expertise that could not just write a check to provide the financial capital, but would bring the relationship capital, the, you know, access to customers, to partners, which are so critical to early stage companies, getting that kind of escape velocity and go on to the next level. So I worked with Kevin for 4 years, and that was a wonderful experience. I both wore the human capital hat across this diverse portfolio. I got to serve on boards and advisory boards, was helping launch as a founding board member and a very interesting interventional cardiology company, excuse me, which was using optics to help diagnose, detect, and treat vulnerable plaque, which is the cause behind most heart attacks. So that was a wonderful run. And then you know, venture, as you know, is great. It's about ideas and possibilities. But I wanted to be an operating company, so I wanted to have that experience as well. So I joined a family office investment platform called Kidd & Company, where I've been a partner for the past 18 going on 19 years, which is focused on investing in the lower middle market of private equity. But this whole time, as I've kind of worn that, as I've not kind of, but as I've worn that traditional hat, you know, I go back to that kid who was moved by the exposure to kids from other schools who didn't have the same set of possibilities that I had, right? And I've been focused on my own balance sheet, investing in companies led by minorities, led by people of color and women, with the intention that that could help create access to employment, access to opportunity for people from the communities that I cared about. And, you know, when you started doing that 20, 25 years ago, everyone looked at you like you were crazy, right? They thought that, kind of like they looked at the environmentalist, right? You know, you wear flannel shirts, you like clean air, you eat granola, right? But what that enabled me to do at that time was build relationships with asset holders and family offices who had the same conviction that I did, that, you know, this is a great way to make an impact, also get returns, because there's this talent out there. They just need an opportunity. I believe it. They believed it. And, you know, I was very fortunate to build relationships with some wonderful people and what we now obviously call the family office space. And inevitably, what we saw was we'd fund a company, we'd see that operator get to a certain point where they needed to raise venture capital. And inevitably, the process of raising venture capital was 10 to 20 times harder. And you just look apples to apples and say, gosh, why is that, right? Because this, if you just look at the pure metrics of what the operator we've backed, what she's done versus the competitors, there's no comparison to quote the Brits, it's like chalk and cheese. And yet the capital raising process was so hard. And that asked the question, you know, what are the demographics of capital allocation? And you look at that and you realize that, you know, ballpark, like 98% of the across the board, all asset classes, it's one demographic that is making these decisions on investing in companies, investing on funds. And that led to the formation of Left Tackle Capital, which was myself and a couple of other partners formed one of the first accelerators to help venture funds led by, you know, the great hidden talent out there, access capital, with a core focus on accessing capital from family offices. So we interviewed 323 funds. We selected 10 to go through a year-long program, and proud to say that, you know, 6 of those 10 got catalytic funding from family offices. 6 of those 10 are on fund 2 right now. And as an extension and a core part of that was we worked with family offices who were helping the managers navigate, you know, diagnose the family office landscape, acting as guides for them to that landscape, sometimes investing in them, and some wonderful families, people like Ben DuPont, Stephen Shia, the Laurie family, the Russell family, Bob Nolan, great people who really had this same conviction we did and said, we're going to help you, and did a great job. And then tried to form a fund of funds with a group of other partners to invest in these fund managers, and just weren't able to get beyond a certain level of commitment. And we effectively did the accelerator again this past year. And now over the past, I want to say 5 to 6 years, have tracked pretty close to 600 funds globally, most of those venture, the rest private equity and private credit, a couple of real estate, less public. And so
let me now again reflect or sort of summarize what I'm hearing, right? And it'll be a better repeat, but you know, you have this transformational journey when you're really young, with the Jack Yates Lions, and playing against them and just opening up a whole bunch of possibilities in terms of exploration in your mind, and you end up a Columbia with your PhD there, but again, international monetary policies, working in Japan for the Ministry of Finance, again, opening up all sorts of different possibilities. You then go to Wall Street. It's a client server time, expertise, the technology. You end up then getting into this, the human capital directly by co-founding RLM Associates. You work with some of the top names in terms of placement. Again, that opens up a lot of possibilities, even breaking new ground, because it's the involvement of technology and so on. And then you want to get additional operational experience. You end up as senior managing director and chief talent officer, Spencer Trask. And that whole mindset there, again, is about a broader kind of perspective, including in healthcare. So I can see what your interest in healthcare. But you've done some amazing sort of talent selection through that process and understanding what happens. You also sat on boards like Prescient Medical, Sessions EDU, Source Food Technologies, and you did some category defining companies during that time, like Next Level Communications. And then you continue on, right? You then form, or you were a partner with Kidd & Company, so that's part of, and you continue to be part of that group, but you also then formed or co-founded Left Tackle Capital, where you then think, you know what, there's an equity out there. There isn't diversity out there. If I'm a certain particular category, let's say I went to Stanford, I grew up and came up on the Mayflower, my chance of getting capital is probably 100 times greater. I'm just kind of making this, but it's a lot greater than if I grew up in some urban community without the economic advantages and all the other historical advantages. And you said, you know what, I want to address that. I want to create something that allows people from diverse backgrounds who have an incredible capability and incredible histories and resilience and persistence and all of the kind of grit aspects that make for success. Why don't we set up a fund of funds where we fund these asset managers, right? And so you interviewed a bunch of, quite hundreds of them, and you, now you've been following their journey and they've had success and you're continuing to do that. So you created with Left Tackle Capital, the first incubator for minority and family asset managers, and then you're continuing that journey. So it's really interesting, this journey that you've been on, but I can see how all of the elements when you were in high school continue in this broadening mindscape that you have here. It kind of reminds me too, I mean, I'm being on the investment committee of the, or I'm part of the investment committee of the Canadian government, BDC Venture Capital, Renewed Venture Capital Initiative, where we do fund of funds, we do private equity, and we do venture capital. But really what we're doing, what you're doing, we will actually fund of funds, but we also fund directly fund managers. And I can only talk about it because it's under NDA, but I can talk about it because they go public announcements. But yeah. But we look at things like diversity. We measure it. We measure diversity and minority and clean tech and things like that to ensure that those aspects are represented, because traditionally those aspects haven't been represented, right? And how do you balance the funding that's out there? So I just love that mindset of, hey, let's make it more equitable, right? Let's make it more inclusive. So did I miss anything in that sort of quick summary?
Yeah, you summarized it better than I did. So thank you for that. No, I think, you know, just the common theme is it's about talent, right? And finding and recognizing that there's talent out there that can perform as well as the best of the best. All they need is opportunity. And, you know, part of a lot of this focus and Barry Johnson, who wrote the policy for Select USA for President Obama, which is, I think, the only thing President Trump didn't dispense with. You know, Barry and I have worked together on this, and he's a real visionary. We've talked about mindset shift, right? And trying to get people to shift mindsets. And that's been part of this journey as well, because making things to, in order for, I think, in order, I believe, in order for inclusion to to really realize it, to realize its full potential, people have to not see it as concessionary or charity. They need to see it as, this is just good business, right? And you know, it's kind of like, if I'm a team drafting a player, I can win by drafting players from, you know, schools that smaller schools, right? It doesn't have to be in Alabama or USC or Ohio State. So that's been a core part of this journey as well, as trying to shift mindsets. And I think we've done it one family office at a time. That's kind of the lane we focus on. But yeah, I would just add that.
Yeah, and you've seen this in other fields, right? And every time there's this idea that it can't be diverse, and then the diversity is introduced, and it's better.
Yeah.
It's like in the NBA now, there's Wemby out of France, right?
Yeah.
And he's kind of lighting up the NBA, but that's because of this sort of diversity. Let's just think out of this peer sort of Amerocentric Mayflower kind of thinking into something that's a little broader, right? And you know, I see that too in all the organizations that are part of this kind of traditional Stanford kind of thinking, or Columbia, thinking something that's a little bit broader, and because there's so much talent out there. And reminds me that Google did a study a while back where it used to be, I'm in the tech field, where you did a preferential hire from MIT, Harvard, Stanford, Caltech, Berkeley, and so on. But then they came out with a study, and they found that after like 4 years, it didn't make any difference. It actually, they had an advantage initially, but after about 4 years, it didn't make any difference. It was then the individual and their capacity for work and resilience and exploration and curiosity and all those other things. And so they in fact, most of the tech firms now have changed their hiring practice. So it's skill-based. If you've got the skills, you can prove it, and you work really hard, then there, you know, the whole opportunity bucket is available to you. And it's not just you grew up under certain circumstances or certain privileges and so on. So, or if you look at a lot of the big tech CEOs are actually come from India, right?
It's interesting. Paul Gumpers at Harvard has done this study on how heterogeneity outperforms across pretty much any asset class to that point. But it's one thing to have data that's intellectual, that's got to connect, I think, with the heart, and people start to see and experience and feel that and truly internalize it. And I hope that day is coming, and hopefully the work that all everyone out there is doing around this helps. Is contributing in its own way, and collectively we, you know, hit that tipping point where, kind of like what Branch Rickey did with Jackie Robinson, right?
Right.
After Jackie Robinson, you know, people said, "Okay, I just want to win," and this is a way to win. So,
you know, I recently, maybe about 2 weeks ago, I read a study where a group of researchers took a look at 18 of the top successful Harvard grads. And they asked them, as startup founders, right? So not as lawyers or as a professional working in a particular field, but as a startup founder, what made for success? And all of them said it wasn't their business skill or their technical skill. It was resilience.
Yes.
And diverse communities are constantly living in this sort of environment of resilience, right? And perseverance and hard work. So, And ultimately, if you can track for that, then that's going to make, from an investment standpoint, it's going to make a better investment, right? It's the team, it's the person. And if they're resilient, don't give up, because you have to pivot when you make investments, then you're going to end up with a greater chance of success. It's kind of like, reminds me of the OpenAI idea. It could have imploded, but it didn't, because there's kind of this resilience. I'm not going to give up. Let's keep trying. That's not to say it's not going to somehow not succeed in the future or and so on, but it's that resilient aspect, I guess, you know, kept it going. So it's remarkable then you're set up this incubator, you invest in fund of funds, but you're definitely looking for diversity and ethnicity, gender, geographic backgrounds, and you're getting results. So you're, as you're saying, it's not concessionary, it's actually you get better results, right? So it makes sense to do this, and it's actually better for the overall community. You're also co-founder of B2Win 360 Capital. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, well, so Left Tackle Capital, with the accelerator, we had the success with the getting the fund. We selected the right fund managers. They were able to get the funding, and what was interesting at the time was it was novel in that our focus was on family offices. I don't know institutions. I do know that they're not moving capital at the rate that they profess or probably could or should, but that's neither here nor there. We focused on family offices. And one of the people I met through the family office circuit was Barry Johnson. I mentioned Barry before. He had worked for President Obama and wrote the policy for Select USA, which effectively said, the essence of that was government needs to focus on business development. We just need to start attracting capital into the United States and into places around the country. And we had ambitions to put together a fund of funds and actually worked on that for a while, brought on Rodrigo Garcia, who was the CIO for the state of Illinois. Eric Yupin was an advisor. Eric was Stanford's endowment's chief investment officer, currently executive chairman of Washington University's endowment, but just ran into headwinds. We had aspirations to raise $500 million. It's had roughly around 10% of that in commitments, but weren't able to go further and abandoned that idea. But effectively took what we did at Left Tackle Capital and repurposed that around what we call the B2Win Institute, the nonprofit. So the accelerator that we had at Left Tackle Capital was a for-profit, and by the way, an experiment, right? It was we were very clear with our investors. This is an experiment. We have this belief that there's talent out there, and there's talent out there that's investable. And you know, your bet is that we can find it and help nurture it and take it to the next level. We'll figure out the business model. But it turns out, I believe an accelerator incubator's better done in a nonprofit than a for-profit for a whole host of reasons. So yeah, the B2Win 360 Capital, that was the aspiration, the vision. We didn't realize it, but we continued with the core mission of getting capital into talented first and second time fund managers through the B2Win Institute, a nonprofit. It's been an incredible ride. We've made an impact and very proud of that. So maybe not the financial impact we wanted, but you know what, we're helping catalyze financial impacts across the country and world now. So that is a good feeling.
You know, well, it's interesting. I mean, you're bridging mainstream wealth holders with skill, right? Venture yeah. managers. And again, you're looking at diversity from an ethnicity standpoint, gender, geographic backgrounds. And so, you know, you're continuing this journey. Do you find then the traditional institutional investors like the pension funds or banks and others, so more of those kind of institutional investors are willing to invest more in these areas, or do you think it's just too front edge and not, you know, like I know that these more traditional PE investors will invest in some, you know, later stage, but do you think there's a mindset to go earlier into these kinds of investments like what you're doing?
I don't. No, and again, full disclosure, I don't have a full sense of that landscape. That's not my world. But through osmosis and the people that we know, it's not. I mean, the pension funds, well, first off, if you think about most of the funds led by underrepresented fund managers tend to be venture funds. They tend to be $50 to $100 million. A lot of institutions have constraints. So the minimum amount they can deploy in any one vehicle is, say, $50 million. They can't be more than 10% of a fund. If you have a $100 million venture fund, you're not going to get a $50 million check just for structural reasons. So that's a surface. I mean, that's a reason frequently, you know, that's given, oh, we'd love to invest in you, but we can't because you're too small. Our check size, our minimum check size is X. We can't be more than a certain percentage of the fund. Well, what Rodrigo Garcia who was part of B2N 360 Capital, what Rigo did when he was chief investment officer for the state of Illinois was he completely rewrote the playbook. He was making investments as small as $400,000 into funds. Helped launch Samira Hernandez with Chingona Ventures, right, with that CGP capital check. So I think it comes down to like a mindset and will. I mean, Rigo did that. And I think that playbook that he did, which was to get more capital into first and second time fund managers, is being replicated, as I understand it, across 15 or so states. So hopefully, and all these things take time with pensions in particular, you know, hopefully we'll start to see a change there, but I haven't seen it to date, at least not at the in terms of the scale and velocity that is reflective of the market opportunity. I think the market opportunity, you know, you look at, just take women's healthcare. I mean, that's a $1 trillion market waiting, that's so underfunded. I mean, someone's going to, at some point, light bulbs are going to go on, and you're going to see more funding into that market. And that's just one example, right? But it's not happened yet. That's, at least that's my view.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. So in, at least in some of the funding I'm doing, at least at the government level I'm involved with, I'm now seeing really the old school starting to move in this direction. And the Canadian government definitely have. In fact, we're the largest investment group in the country, and Canada's ranked in the top five in venture capital investments in the 38 countries of the OECD. And rather than, I don't represent the government. I just happen to have sat on some investment selection committees and so on, but and only could talk about it just because they've gone public with some of this information. So I encourage your audience to go public, because I'm now going from memory. But so we are the biggest investor, direct investor. We are the biggest investor into the whole investment community, whether it's a fund of funds or private equity or venture capital and fund managers. But we definitely want diversity. I mean, it's in there, right? So we measure it, we factor it. In fact, we have specific deployments, one called Inclusive Growth Stream, which takes this into account. We actually weight heavier, and that's to get more diversity and so on. So it's part of the BDC Capital or BDC Business Development Corporation Canada program, but we're a model for other countries, right? And I know that, you know, the Western countries anyways, they work together in some ways. So And our investment thesis is online. The things that we measure, even the percentages that we give for what we're looking for, we're transparent. And it's an open process for people to apply, right? So, for example, if B2Win 360 had a Canadian operation, you could apply.
Yeah.
Right? So,
Well, maybe we should have launched in Canada.
So keep that in mind. If you have a Canadian operation and you are and will invest some of that in the Canadian ecosystem, then you can apply, and it's an interesting process. But you're definitely like the North Star, right? Because to me, I think this is where things are heading. I believe that even in the Gulf states, that there will be some more allocation in this area. That's a broader and not so sort of kind of old school PE thinking, but more early and diversity. So what are your feelings about that? Do you think it's going to move in this direction? I guess I'm getting a lot of my own opinion, but what are your feelings, or it's not going to happen?
No, I'm an optimist by nature. So I do believe I do believe it will happen, simply because of the fact that I believe that, and I've seen it in sport. We've seen it in sports, right? We've seen it also in a lot of the, adoption of some of the, like electric vehicles, some of the clean tech solutions here. It's because it makes a difference in the pocketbook. In other words, it's good business, right? And I do believe that the talent is out there. It just needs a chance to shine. It's starting to shine. We're starting to see, in the field I'm involved with, women's healthcare, we're starting to see these unicorns happen. So eventually, you know, you have enough success points. The optimist in me says capital is going to flow there because that's where they make money. You know, I look at, I go back to just a quick story for you, a sports story. So Alabama, right? Not necessarily the place that you think about it being inclusive and diverse. Bear Bryant was the coach of Alabama football and they were segregated. He called his friend John Robinson at USC in 1973 and said, and John Robinson had an integrated team, had, I believe, a Samoan American quarterback. He said, please come play us in Alabama. And that integrated team beat mighty Alabama, beat the hell out of them. And guess what? All of a sudden, they desegregated sports. Fans wanted to win, right? So you've seen it in these places of deep resistance, again, in other fields. And all of a sudden, the light bulb goes off. This is about winning. I want to be on the winning side. I want to make money. This is good business. So the optimist in me says that the tipping point is coming. I hope it comes soon. But I do believe it'll happen.
So let's get into some other aspects that you're involved with. It's interesting. I mean, I do keynotes and because I'm like a foresight. So I do private and public keynotes. I just did one. And I predict that the overall healthcare market's about 16 to 18 trillion by 2025. So it's a huge opportunity, right?
Yes. Well, it's also, it's interesting too, is you have diseases like Alzheimer's, right? Where 60% of the patients are women, 80% of the autoimmune patients are women. So if you think about women's healthcare, investing in understanding that those diseases, maybe it's different metabolic pathways that are unique to women, but the addressing women's healthcare, it will have broader externalities for men's healthcare as well, for the whole population, right? And in addition to, you know, obviously women living longer, healthier lives, we know those externalities in terms of what that means for commute families and communities. But I also think a lot of the funding will have spillovers to the broader healthcare market. And that's exciting.
Really fascinating. I just want to mine some additional aspects in this interview. Sure. You're a founding advisor, board member and of these impact organizations like Maverick Collective, Young Audiences, Young Audience Charter School New Orleans. Can you talk more about that work? It's interesting.
Yeah, well, I talk about Young Audiences. So Young Audiences uses arts and education to inspire a lifelong love of learning in kids. We focus on the K through 12 space. And it's not arts for art's sake, but using, again, arts to unlock a lifelong love of learning. And it's just a terrific organization. And I've been on the board since 2009, was a founding board member of the charter school in New Orleans, which was deeply meaningful. I grew up in San Antonio, but I was born in New Orleans, have a lot of relatives in New Orleans. And I'll tell you a story. The charter school we launched in New Orleans is in Gretna, which is in, you know, working class community, I think firemen, policemen. And the first time I went to the school, I was supposed to have a meeting, I think at 8 o'clock, but being geographically challenged, I always leave a couple of hours early to make sure that I get there on time. I wound up getting there around 6:30 in the morning. And I saw these people walking out. This is in July in New Orleans, so it's, I think, hot, humid. And I saw these people walking out of the school covered in sweat and soot. And I said, what are you doing here? Wait, you know, what's going on? And they said, our kids are going to go to school here. We're getting it ready for the fall. And it was the first arts and education. It is the first, and I think still to this day, the only arts and education charter school in the U.S. So yeah, it's a great, great, great organization that's impacting, you know, 4 to 6 million kids a year. So very, very proud to be a part of that. And I love the concept, right? It's really meeting kids where they are. And, you know, we do things like, just a quick example, think about teaching empathy. This is a dated example, but one of my favorites, imagine the kids reading Little Red Riding Hood the traditional way. And then you read this alternative version where the wolf is a mother with four hungry cubs, right? So kind of cool stuff like that. And that's lots of different examples, but that's Young Audiences.
And you could integrate you know, these large language models into some of this ideation brainstorming,
right? Oh my God. Yes. Yeah. When I think about the potential for all the work on AI, and it's just, it's breathtaking and exciting, right?
So James, you've got this amazing background and journey, one of constant inspiration and change and diversity and resilience as well, but tremendous growth with all the people you've touched, but including yourself, you're constantly growing, right?
Yes.
So what is James version 100 going to look like?
I don't know, Stephen. Good question. Here's what I want to continue to leverage, whatever time and talent, and to a lesser extent, treasure, to continue to make an impact, right? In as many ways as I can. I do believe I'm best suited to do that through private markets and private markets investing, and I'd like to, I think the next version of myself, and part of what I'm thinking through now, is how do I do this on a broader global scale? Because I think that I love the learning. My instinct is there's all kinds of solutions and collaborations out there that I'd love to find and discover and help connect for a greater good. So I'm thinking through what that looks like, but I know that'll be a part of it.
I see. So what I'm hearing is you've had this amazing journey, and you want to continue to scale this in every possible way that you can think of, right?
Yes. And yeah, I've had a blessed journey. So, and I've worked with great people. So that's, as we know, right, that makes it all the more richer and rewarding.
Yeah, and it's a trusted network, right? Trust is so important, and good friends. And as you mentioned, you still have friends with that 1981 Houston Jack Yates Lions group, right?
Yeah, I so cherish my time, spending time with them. They forever shaped the course of my life, and hopefully to some extent I've had a positive impact on their life. But I do enjoy getting together with them. So,
yeah, and there's this common thread. So you have friends from the 70s, friends from the 81, from this Jack Yates story. You have friends from your PhD in yes. Economics at Columbia. You have friends from your Japanese Ministry of Finance.
Yeah.
You have friends from your RLM associates and all the work you did there. And then, of course, from Spencer Trask and the Peel Capital Group, and of course, Kidd & Company, Left Tackle Capital. And then, of course, you have your friends with Maverick Collective, Young Audiences, the Charter School, and there's so much more. I mean, we could have delved into all the associated companies and things like that. Or just before we came on, you mentioned Audria.
Oh my God! Yeah, the Vine. I mean, the most, to me, extraordinary community of family offices. Yeah. Impact related people, governments. I mean, what Audrey has built is incredible. And she's, yeah, I always tell people, describe Audrey. I said, she's like an angel that God sent down to save us from ourselves. I mean, I think the curating and connecting she's doing is having great impact, and she's special. And that community is special. That's how I met you. So I'm really blessed and grateful for it.
And I forgot to mention Bedouin Capital. And of course, you're Bedouin. Yeah. Bedouin Institute as well, right? So.
Yes, yes.
So James, I just fascinated with what you're doing. I very much respect and admire what you're doing. And I'm a big believer in trying to support, everything that you're doing, because I just think it's marvelous work. It's going to make a better world, but for all. So not just for humanity, but for all, the bigger bucket, and for all Earth ecosystems. So thank you again for coming in. Oh. I should mention, what's your recommendation for the audience? I have one more question. So thank you for coming in, but what's your last recommendation for your audience? What do you want to leave them with?
I'm an optimist, right? So I would say have faith that the world's going to work itself through these troubled times. And I believe that's a sentiment that you share. I think you have a time frame in mind. I don't know if I have a time frame, but I'm optimistic that as dark as things may seem and are now, we will work through it. So that's what I'd leave.
Yeah, this idea of Angela Duckworth and grit, right? You know, so, and, yes. And combined with optimism and hard work and perseverance and resilience and so on. So James, again, thank you for coming in. Just a marvelous insight you give to the audience. You're very inspiring, and you're going to inspire the audience to do more. So thank you again for sharing so much with us.
Well, thank you for everything you do, Stephen. Appreciate it, and an honor to be on the program with you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.